So we're continuing to work through the book of Exodus. We're in chapter 17, and our passage this morning is the one I read, verses 8 to 16. Now there's a whole Old Testament subplot which begins here in this passage. The Amalekites' treatment of Israel in Exodus 17 becomes significant during the reign of King Saul much later on, and is part actually of Saul being rejected by Yahweh and replaced with David. And it then becomes significant again much later still during the time of Mordecai and Esther, the events we're looking at on Wednesday evenings with Michael. So what we have in front of us this morning is not a detached, self-contained little passage. It's intimately related to other material. It invites us to move out from Exodus 17 and make wider connections. And we are going to do that this morning. That is going to be our approach, but not in the way that I've just led you to expect. We're not going to go to 1 Samuel this morning and consider Saul's disastrous dealings with the Amalekites. We're not going to go to the book of Esther this morning and consider one Amalekite's attempt to reverse Exodus 17:14 and blot out the memory of Israel from under heaven. We're not going to connect this passage to a bigger story by way of that particular plot line, fascinating as it is. There's rather another plot line that is going to heavily influence our handling of these verses, and I'll introduce you to that in just a minute. So I have three simple headings for you this morning, continuing in the letter P vein from Michael's talk on Wednesday night. And first of all then, God's purpose. God's purpose. Now on the face of things, the opening verse of our passage is highly depressing. It's reminiscent of autumn 2020. In the spring of last year, we'd all been in lockdown, and that, of course, was very hard. But then you remember we had a summer of relative freedom, able to go on holiday, able to have people in our homes, and it made us all optimistic. We knew there were other challenges ahead, like getting the country's beleaguered economy back on its feet, but at least the grim reality of lockdown was behind us. And then came the autumn, and COVID cases began to rise again, and no vaccine had yet emerged, and suddenly we found ourselves back to square one, back to online church services and minimal social contact, back to dreaded lockdown. Now think of the Israelites in this new post-Exodus existence of theirs. And the first challenge which they had had to face was a pursuing enemy, the Egyptians, of course, advancing against them as they were camped on the shores of the Red Sea. And that had been a deeply distressing experience, but Yahweh had come to their rescue and dealt with the Egyptians, and they had moved on from that episode. And they then had to face other challenges, the challenge of travelling through a barren desert landscape, and particularly the challenge presented by their own sinful tendencies. But at least it wasn't the sound of thundering hooves getting closer and closer. At least it wasn't the panic of being under attack. At least it wasn't a pursuing army like before. At least that kind of crisis was behind them. Now they were the right side of the Red Sea. And then we come to Exodus 17 verse 8. And what do we have? The sound of thundering hooves getting closer and closer to the Israelites. The panic of being under attack, a pursuing enemy, just like at the Red Sea. It makes the return of lockdown in autumn 2020 appear very mild and tolerable by comparison. And so it seems, as I say, highly depressing, and particularly when you consider this attack by the Amalekites, it isn't a predictable, necessary evil. I'm reading just now the story of a man who kayaked around the entire coastline of Scotland. And prior to his expedition, this man had a temporary job as a nighttime security guard at an office of an Aberdeen oil company. And he used those quiet nighttime shifts to do detailed planning. He had the 41 OS maps that he needed, and he spent the nights covering these maps with copious annotations, every tidal anomaly, every coastal hazard. He wrote on those maps all the information that he would need. Unfortunately, things went pear-shaped when one morning the company boss arrived at work to find his security man slouched on the executive swivel chair, snoring, at the desk in front of him covered with maps, compasses, and tidal timetables. But if Moses had taken the same approach to Israel's journey as that man did with his kayaking expedition, if he had invested in all the relevant OS maps and familiarized himself to the nth degree with every single difficulty and danger they would potentially encounter, he wouldn't have included in his planning what happens in Exodus 17 verse 8. Next to the name Rephidim on his map of the Sinai Peninsula, he might have inserted the comment water scarce, but he wouldn't have inserted the comment Amalekite territory. Because it wasn't. One writer puts it this way: all other extant historical records about these people place them normally in the northern Sinai or Midian or the Negev of Canaan, making the battle at Rephidim their most southerly foray on record. So as I say, what happens here is not a predictable, necessary evil for any group of people traveling from Egypt to Canaan. Rather, it almost seems as if the Israelites have this perverse magnetic thing going on. They just kind of attract pursuing enemies, so that even the people of Amalek way up there in the north somehow feel the pull and are drawn across the miles of desert expanse in order to launch an attack. What a depressing thing. What a depressing thing this seems to be. Or at least, so it seems, until we zoom out a bit from Exodus 17. Remember I said in my introduction, we were going to make wider biblical connections this morning. Instinctively, as I said, we go forward, don't we, to 1 Samuel and Esther. Actually, the most important connection, I think, requires us to go backwards. Backwards to a text which most of you will know. Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. Do you remember God's words in that verse to Satan? I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. What's God saying there? He's saying this day in the Garden of Eden marks the beginning of a great conflict. A great conflict between my people who know and love me and Satan's people who don't. There won't be peace between these two camps. A spirit of live and let live. No, enmity. Acrimony, hostility, that is what there will be. And in page after page of the Old Testament, we see the outworking of that. Israel's constantly assailed, constantly attacked condition in the Old Testament, it isn't some rotten streak of bad luck. It's that enmity God had announced in the Garden of Eden. And Exodus 17 verse 8 then is the outworking of Genesis 3:15. What are the odds, a casual reader of Exodus might say, what are the odds of Israel experiencing one pursuing enemy, the Egyptians, and then so soon after experiencing another pursuing enemy, the people of Amalek? What are the odds of a people group as geographically removed as the Amalekites, without any satellite technology sniffing out the Israelites' presence in Rephidim and coming so far south to attack them? What are the odds of these things happening? It's a crazy sequence of events. But you see, in view of Genesis 3:15, it's not a crazy sequence of events at all. Of course, the Israelites are a magnet for pursuing enemies. Of course, the Amalekites must follow hard on the heels of the Egyptians. There's a conflict going on. There's that enmity declared by the lips of God himself. Those two camps demarcated in Genesis 3:15 cannot be at peace. Even in a lonely desert spot like Rephidim, the war between them must raise its head. But you might be thinking, well, okay, that text in Genesis explains what happens here in Exodus 17, verse 8 then, but it doesn't really make it any less depressing, does it? When it rains all day, like it did yesterday, the fact that the weather forecasters announced beforehand it's going to happen doesn't make the situation all that much better. And similarly, surely, God's announcement in Eden doesn't make the spectacle of these pursuing Amalekites all that much better. It makes the spectacle comprehensible, perhaps, but not welcome. You might be thinking that. But I would disagree. Because actually, in Genesis 3:15, God does more than simply announce that enmity between the two camps. He puts it in a certain context. He presents it as a build-up to something else. A build-up to the total defeat of Satan himself. There will be the conflict between God's people and Satan's people, and then following on from that, there will be this focused, once-for-all defeat of Satan himself, the crushing of his head, as the divine announcement phrases it. In other words, as we watch these Amalekites in Exodus 17, verse 8, as we watch them advancing, the dust having barely settled from the Egyptians' advance a little earlier, as we watch the Amalekites advancing, we're certainly not watching some bizarre freak occurrence of lightning striking twice. As we've said, this kind of thing was foretold in Genesis 3. But nor are we watching then the grim fulfillment of some terribly miserable divine prophecy. Rather, we are watching part of the build-up to Satan's defeat. We are watching the necessary preliminaries to the serpent's head being crushed. Think of it this way. If the Israelites were just to get on with their lives unmolested by marauding Amalekites and their ilk, little evidence on display of that bitter conflict raging on, there would then be little reason to believe that the serpent's skull was ever in fact going to lie in 1,000 shattered pieces. But if the conflict is very much alive and well, and the Israelites are dogged by adversaries quite literally going out of their way, perhaps large distances out of their way, to harass them, then there's every reason to believe that God's purpose of bringing down his great enemy Satan is resolutely moving forward. And that's why my first heading then is God's purpose. I want us to marvel at the magnificent fixedness of God's purpose. How often have you and I, faced with some setback or some challenge, resolved in the heat and passion of the moment, we're going to do something about it? But then time has gone by and those feelings have cooled and the resolution has petered out. And here's God. And in Eden, Satan has pulled off this coup. And in the heat and passion of the moment, God has resolved he's going to do something about it. But now, in the heart of the book of Exodus, we're no longer in Eden. Centuries have gone by. Gallons of water have passed under the bridge. Surely God's earlier feelings will have cooled now. And his earlier resolution will have petered out. Surely the demise of Satan isn't still going to be on the cards after all this time. But wonderfully, wonderfully, it is still on the cards. Egyptians and Amalekites are falling over each other to lay the boot into God's people. The enmity of Genesis 3:15 is unmistakable, which means the build-up to Satan's defeat is in full swing. What a God! What a God! Undeflected from his purpose, fixatedly, unrelentingly, pursuing it, working inexorably toward that moment when hell's serpent will lie smashed, slain, and altogether vanquished. It's an inspiring and rousing theme, God's purpose in all its marvellous undeflectableness. God's purpose. Secondly, notice with me, God's pulse beat. God's pulse beat. How come then he remains, after all this time, so undeflected from his purpose? How do we account for that? Well, there's doubtless more than one answer to that question. We could go down this route. We could say God has an elect people whose salvation depends on Satan's defeat. And his love for them then will not allow him to falter until Satan is indeed defeated. That's an attractive answer to the question, and it's a correct answer to the question. It's legitimate to trace the resoluteness of God's Satan-defeating purpose to his extravagant love for his people. But I want to highlight just now a different answer. I want to highlight this different answer because it's more ultimate and because it surfaces in our text. So far, we've really only considered the first verse of this morning's passage. Let's jump now to the other end of it. And in verses 14 to 16, we have a bit of a sandwich. So verse 14 is Yahweh promising to Moses he'll in the future deal ruthlessly with the Amalekites. And then the end of verse 16 is Moses declaring that Yahweh will in the future deal ruthlessly with the Amalekites. But in between, in the middle of the sandwich, we have Moses explaining this divine hostility. He builds an altar and he gives the altar a name. And then he says this at the beginning of verse 16, a hand, and the ESV has it, upon the throne of the Lord. But you could translate the preposition there differently. And I think the preposition which you find, I can't remember whether it's in the NIV's main text or in the NIV's footnote text, but the way it's translated there, I think, is preferable, a hand against the throne of the Lord. A hand against the throne of the Lord. And the hand, then, to which Moses is referring is, I think, the Amalekites' hand. In other words, what has caused Yahweh's hostility here, more than anything, isn't the Amalekites' callousness, their brutality, their lust for conquest and plunder. Doubtless all of those do play a part in God's outrage and anger, because we know Yahweh hates such things. But what has aroused his anger more than anything is the Amalekites' brazen defiance. Israel's passage from Egypt to Canaan is his, Yahweh's project. And he is God. He runs the universe. He calls the shots. He is on the throne. And the Amalekites then, by seeking to disrupt Israel's passage, they are insolently challenging God's sovereignty of his own universe. They are striking their hand against his very throne, and he won't have that. Isaiah 48:11, how can my name be profaned? My glory I will not give to another. The divine pulse beat to which I'm referring in my second heading this morning, it's that concern that God has for his own glory. No serious reader of the Bible can miss it throbbing away there in the heart of God. And it's the reason then that God is not going to rest until these defiant Amalekites have been removed from under heaven. And I think God stands toward the Amalekites enables us to answer the question which I posed a moment ago. How come the events of Eden now being such a distant memory, how come God's purpose of bringing down Satan is still in the book of Exodus so undiminished? Well, it's because Satan's strike there in Genesis 3 was the most colossal act of brazen defiance. God, as the great cosmic king, had arranged his universe in such a way that Adam would be like his son, lovingly obeying him and living in intimate fellowship with him. And Satan came along and willfully disrupted all that, poisoning Adam, poisoning his obedience, poisoning his fellowship with God. And in doing so then, he was directly challenging God's sovereignty. how you want this universe to be arranged, God, counts for nothing. I'm going to rearrange it and bend things into the shape that I want them to be. He was striking his hand against God's throne. And in striking his hand against God's throne, he was jangling the rawest nerve that there is in the being of God. He was pitting himself against this divine pulse beat, this concern in the heart of God for his own glory. This is what lies behind the most striking feature, actually, of Genesis 3:15. The fact that God gives this forecast of what is going to happen in the future, not to Adam and Eve, but to Satan. I well remember my attention first being drawn to the significance of that, probably 20 years ago now, encountering these words by Robert Candlish in his 19th century commentary on Genesis. He wrote, "Why this indirect mode of conveying such an assurance of mercy? Why does God speak to the serpent and not to our first parents themselves?" And he answers, "May it not be to intimate that the main and chief end of God in the dispensation of grace is his own glory? It is not because they have deserved anything at his hands, nor is it merely out of compassion to them that he interferes, but it concerns his honor that the adversary should not triumph. For his own namesake, he must needs be glorified in the overthrow of the great enemy who has apparently frustrated the chief end of his creation of the world." Do you get that? In Genesis 3:15, God is not saying, "Poor Adam and Eve, this nasty serpent has ruined you, but don't worry, I'm going to come and rescue you." No, he's saying this, "Satan, how dare you lift your hand against my throne? I will overturn this rebellion and reassert my glory in my universe." And that's why then we get to the book of Exodus and he's undeflected from his purpose. And you dip into any part of the Old Testament and you find God is still undeflected from his purpose of bringing down Satan. Because he will not give his glory to another. That's his pulse beat. And he cannot possibly rest until the enemy who has struck his hand against his very throne has been utterly destroyed. And I can't leave this theme without just quoting Candlish's concluding sentences in that section of his commentary, because he continues in this way. He says, "And does not this view render the assurance of mercy to our race even more strong and emphatic than if it were immediately given to Adam and Eve themselves? It humbles our first parents and us in them, and yet it also encourages them and us." What is our ultimate assurance? That the day will finally come when Satan has been confined irreversibly to the lake of fire, and when there is a new world devoid of any slightest trace of his handiwork, the curse entirely lifted, suffering and sadness and sin and death gone forever, not a speck of the serpent's slimy trail anywhere to be seen. What is our ultimate assurance that day will finally come? Well, there are many grounds to be assured of it. Many grounds that are significant and substantial and warrant much consideration, but our ultimate assurance is this. Anything else would mean at least a partial victory for the one who so brazenly held up his hand against the throne of God. Anything else would represent at least a sliver of a victory for the defiant serpent. And that is unthinkable. Unthinkable in the light of God's deep-seated concern for his own glory. So be assured. Be assured that that day will finally come. Be assured by God's pulse beat. His pulse beat throbbing away. "I will not give my glory to another." be assured on that basis, the day that we all long for so much will finally transpire. God's purpose, God's pulse beat. But then thirdly and finally this morning, God's policy. God's policy. I'm sure some of you are fans of the classic sitcom Dad's Army. And aside then from just all the specific, funny jokes that litter every episode of Dad's Army, I guess at the heart of its humour is this idea of a motley bunch of men with their blend of inexperience and infirmity resisting Hitler's formidable forces. Now, we need to understand that the Amalekites were formidable. They're described, interestingly, in Numbers 24, verse 20, as being first among the nations. These are not some ethnic footnote in the ancient Near East. First among the nations. Indeed, the very fact that, as we said earlier, they can travel so far from their native region in order to attack the Israelites, that itself is pretty impressive. One writer notes the Amalekites had domesticated the camel and used its swiftness effectively in surprise attacks. Actually, you see that in the book of Judges, don't you, at the time of Gideon. They came every year during harvest on their camels in order to plunder Israel's harvest. And then this writer adds, over short distances, this was new to me, but over short distances, camels can run 45 miles per hour, considerably faster than a horse. And in the face of this attack then, by these formidable Amalekites, the Israelites, they have something of Dad's army about them, do they not? I mean, notice, for starters, the interesting way in which, in verse 9, one of the Bible's key characters is introduced into the Bible with such little fanfare. Moses said to Joshua, "Choose for us men." Joshua. This is the Joshua. And it's the first time we've met him in the whole of the Bible. You'd expect a bit of fanfare, wouldn't you? And the commentators really puzzle over this. I think the point probably is that the narrator is trying to put us in the shoes of the Israelites that day. And they didn't know that Joshua was going to become this great person that we now know he became. And he was utterly inexperienced. He wasn't this great military general at that point with medals dangling from him. He was just this random guy that they were having to put at the front of the army in order to try and resist this marauding force that had come against them. To make things worse, the biggest name in the Israelite ranks, well, he beetles off to the top of a hill at this point. Now, the reason for that is that he's going to repeat the whole Red Sea thing. And he's going to go there, verse 9, with the staff in his hand. And you know how previously then he'd held up his staff and through the night the waters of the Red Sea had parted, and he's going to take the same approach here, and he's going to hold up his staff. And in that way, they'll resist this army that's come against them. Which sounds good, except that either because a battle takes an awful lot longer than the parting of a sea, or because Moses perhaps has deteriorated in his health since then and isn't in as good a shape as he was, for whatever reason, he can't manage to hold up the staff for the length of time that's required. And it's a bit like Godfrey, isn't it, in Dad's Army? This kind of pathetic geriatric who just can't really cope with what's going on. And very humiliatingly then, he has to be helped by Aaron and Hur, who get a stone for him to sit on. And then they take it in turns. And he has the staff in his right hand, and one of them holds up that arm. And then he transfers the staff to his other hand, and the other one holds up that arm. And it's all a bit pathetic and a bit sad. And you can imagine then, the enemy having a good laugh here as they turn up and find this scene going on. You can imagine them vying with each other as to who can make the wittiest jokes about the Israelites' inadequacies. You can imagine them enjoying great merriment. Until, that is, verse 13 comes along. And this elite Amalekite army languishes defeated at the hands of Joshua. God often causes things to unfold in this way, wiping the smiles off his enemies' faces through implausible victories that you could not possibly have seen coming. It's his policy. That's what my third heading refers to. It's his policy. Indeed, this takes us one more time to that great plot line that we've touched on so much this morning. I said that Genesis 3:15 foretold this conflict between the two camps, God's people, Satan's people. And it foretold that conflict then as the build-up to this more focused combat that would follow, in which Satan himself would be utterly defeated. Well, let's go for a moment there to the point where Satan is defeated. And it's early on a Friday morning, and Jesus is making his weary way from Jerusalem to the place called Golgotha. And he hasn't slept for hours, and he's been flogged twice, and his body is torn and bleeding, and he's weak. He can barely stand. He can't carry his cross all the way. He looks a pathetic, lamentable, pitiful figure. And you can imagine Satan and his most eminent demons watching that scene. And even though they have a pretty clear understanding of the person and work of Christ and what he's come to do and how he's come to save his people, even they, at that moment, perhaps they start to feel a little bit more optimistic. Surely he can't pull this off now. Not from this position. Not stumbling along the road as the crowd laugh at him. Surely this has gone too far even for him now to pull off the kind of victory he always said he was coming to pull off. And the scene unfolds, and the scene unfolds. And you get to mid-afternoon on that Friday, and that Jesus Christ is crying out, "It is finished." And Satan lies vanquished at his feet. Implausibly, unimaginably, this weak Saviour conquers the infant weak we sang, who breaks the powers of hell. And this policy, then, of our God's, seen in Exodus 17, seen supremely on Good Friday outside Jerusalem, this policy, I think it applies in our Christian lives too. Satan, of course, is defeated now since the cross, but pending his actual destruction in the lake of fire, to which I referred a moment ago, he is in the meantime allowed some liberty to assault God's people still. We all know that. We know that theologically, and we know it experientially. He can throw nasty circumstances at believers in order to get at them and try to trip them up. I've commented before on the strangely personal pronoun that Paul uses in Romans 8, the passage we read earlier on. Who shall separate us from the love of God? Love of Christ, sorry. Shall trouble, hardship, persecution, famine, nakedness, danger, sword? Shouldn't it be, what shall separate us? When he then lists all those impersonal things, no, who shall separate us? Because Satan is the one who throws at us famine, nakedness, danger, trouble, hardship, persecution, in order to try and trip us up. And he can leave us in a very pathetic looking state that way. He can leave us flawed. He can leave us really struggling, gasping for breath in our Christian lives. And in those moments then, when he's thrown something at us, and he's flawed us, no doubt he stands back and laughs at this victory he's won over us. And then what happens? By the enabling Spirit of God, that poor believer lying prostrate on the ground simply goes on to exercise more faith and more dependence upon God than ever in his or her life before. And suddenly the smile is wiped off Satan's face. That's what Paul means, more than conquerors. Through him who loved us. More than conquerors. Not in the sense that we somehow manage to avoid all these nasty things that Satan throws at us. But as he throws them at us, and as we are floored by them, we simply use those things as springboards and ammunition to trust in God more deeply and more resolutely than ever before. And in our weakness, we win these victories over the evil one. And perhaps that's where you're at this morning. Perhaps you're feeling very, very weak. Perhaps Satan is throwing very nasty things at you in your life. And you feel like you're lying in the dust. And you feel like you're in such a low, low place. God's policy is to wipe the smile off the enemy's face through the most implausible victories. And as you, by God's grace, keep on going despite having been flawed by the enemy, and become stronger through this setback that you're presently going through, in that way, God will wipe the smile off the one who has tripped you up and sent these adversities your way. May God encourage us. Amen. Well, let's just close.